monsters in my head. I'm scared of love. Funny people, listen up. It's never too late to change your luck. So don't let them steal your life. To revolution.
All right, once again, it is the It's Going Down podcast. Today, we are overjoyed to bring you an exclusive interview with the Crime Think X Workers Collective. We have a member that's going to be on the line momentarily that's going to be talking about a whole range of things. We're going to be talking about the recent bombing by the Trump administration of Syria. We're going to be talking, looking back at the anarchist movement the last several months since Trump has been in office. We're going to be talking about the ins and outs of the Trump administration itself. We're going to be talking about the rise of far right violence and activity that hasn't subsided since Trump has come in. And we're going to be talking moreover about how we as a movement can overcome our shortcomings and continue to grow and expand as we continue on the trajectory that we have set out for ourselves in the last several months of high pace, high energy activity on the streets of the U.S. and across so-called North America. We're really excited to bring you this interview today. Really excited that Crime Think could join us. Once again, if you want to donate to It's Going Down, if you want to help keep us going, please go on to itsgoingdown.org. Sign up to become a monthly sustainer. We said this in the last episode, but we're going to say it again in the next several weeks. We are going to be transitioning to Patreon, which is, we hope, will be a more sustainable way for us to continue and grow as a project, as a news source, as a hub, as a digital community center for the anarchist movement with the wider world and the greater public. We hope that you join us in this endeavor. We hope that you sign up. We hope that you can donate every single month, even if it's a few dollars. It all really helps. It all helps us continue. It helps us grow, helps us sustain our activity, helps us pay people to do this work. It's not easy to do this full time. We need your help. If you enjoy It's Going Down, if you enjoy what we're doing, if you hope that we continue and grow stronger, we need you to step on board and step up and help us continue to do exactly that. Without further ado, here's somebody from the Crime Think X Workers Collective. Thanks a lot for listening. Let's get into it. Okay, we're joined here today on the It's Going Down podcast with a participant in the Crime Think X Workers Collective. It's an international network of different anarchist cells, collectives, and projects. Crime Think, in the last several decades, has been an ongoing and just timeless resource that people have, you know, looked to for analysis for everything from stickers to posters. And we're just really glad to have you all on to talk about what's been going on in the United States the last couple months. Right now, we're coming out of a week of solidarity and action with people facing repression from Sacramento to Standing Rock to those facing charges from the J20. We're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to talk specifically about anarchist resistance, about how anarchists have responded to Trump, but moreover, just how the Trump administration has played out this last couple of months. Does this live up to the predictions that we had before Trump came into power? How is they not? How have we as a movement responded to Trump? In what ways have we dropped the ball or failed? What ways have we done well? What can we learn from these shortcomings and these successes and go forward? And moreover, just talk about the state of the world. This has been a busy week. Trump administration has, on top of dropping bombs in Yemen and other countries, they've moved to attack bases in Syria. What does this mean? What is the breaking apart of the Bannonite, quote-unquote, economic nationalists with the more middle of the road, neoconservative and neoliberal people within the Trump administration? What does this mean? and everything else. We got a lot of ground to cover. You want to just say anything, introduce yourself or Crime Think at all?
I'm just glad to be here. If people want to learn about Crime Think, they can go to crimethink.com.
Cool. All right, well, let's just get into it. So first question, we're now several months into the Trump administration itself. What are your thoughts at this point? Crime Think has obviously written a lot. It's Going Down has written a lot. There's been a lot that was speculated before Trump came in. How does the reality of what the Trump administration have done measure up to any initial speculation or predictions before Trump came into power?
Well, it was hard to know exactly what to expect. I mean, because Trump's election hit so many of us in the United States as a surprise, really, you know, just because we didn't realize how quickly history was moving, right? So when Trump was elected, we were like, we knew that this far right momentum was gathering steam, you know, from Brazil to Ukraine to France, you know, but we didn't really anticipate, I think most people didn't anticipate that Trump would come into power, that we were so far down this trajectory already. So it was hard then to really look several months in advance, let alone, you know, years in advance, and really be able to guess what it would be like. I think that at the time, the horizon was still open for it to turn out really badly. It might still, but we can congratulate ourselves, like, you know, anarchists and other participants in the social movements, that that we actually have fended off the worst case scenario, you know, because I mean, Trump's intentions are as bad as we expected. I think that was something that people confirmed in the first week. But also, thus far, he has failed worse than anybody anticipated as well. One of our hopes in November, when the election results came back, was that this far right momentum that had been gaining steam all around the world had come to power in the United States, you know, in the center of global governance, had come to power too early, that they were coming into control of, you know, all three branches of government in probably the most powerful empire the solar system has ever seen, but before they had a full social consensus, you know. So our goal at that juncture was to break any sort of image of consensus, any impression that Trump was going to be, you know, the president of a united America or something, to convey that business as usual under him would be impossible. And in doing so, you know, to send a signal flare up for participants in social movements or anybody who is angry about the situation to get with us, but also to give politicians, judges, anybody in the government or anybody associated with the status quo an incentive to break ranks, you know, to realize that this new strategy for how to maintain the stability of global capitalism, in which they would shift to, like, you know, not the carrot, but the stick, right? To shift to this sort of, you know, violent nationalism, that strategy was not going to work. That we would sort of do some pushback, establish a rapport of force. And I think in that regard, we succeeded. I think thus far we can congratulate ourselves on that. So go ahead then.
Now that Trump is officially the most unpopular president this close out of the gate, I think the last results I read was he was at 34%. The media is speculating that Trump's numbers will actually increase. I don't actually know if that's true. I mean, obviously, a lot of the media is aligned with the Democrats, and they're kind of overjoyed that Trump is going after Assad in Syria. So I think that they almost might be kind of like prepping the groundwork, like, oh yeah, Trump's actually a really great guy. You know, Trump is bombing people in Syria. But what does it mean for anarchists that Trump's popularity is so low? Does that impact what we do? I mean, what does this say about the state and the state of the state in 2017? Yeah, any thoughts on that? Just the unpopularity of Trump and just the failing legitimacy of the state itself.
Well, as others have pointed out, the Democrats are actually less popular than Trump. You know, there's anybody who is president of the United States right now would be unpopular, might even be this unpopular. You know, we have a theory developed over the last several years of internal dialogue. The state itself is like a hot potato right now. whoever it is that holds the reins of the state is not going to be able to retain their popularity. Looking at what happened to Morsi coming out of the Egyptian revolution, you know, that toppled Mubarak, and then, you know, a year later, it's you know, the same for Morsi. You know, we formulated this hypothesis, and given what's happened to Syriza, about whom there is so much enthusiasm, basically everybody who says, you know, we can come in and take state power and fix things is going to disappoint people, because the crisis of capitalism has reached such a, you know, such a level of intensity that there's nothing the state can really do to resolve people's problems. Mm-hmm. So in this situation, the position of rebel, the position of underdog is the most desirable position, really. You know, that's why, Trump and the alt-right were able to gain such momentum so quickly. It was that under Obama, they could present themselves as the alternative. They could present themselves as the rebels, right? Now that they're in power, everybody who is looking to them, believing that they could fix things, is in for a wake-up call. We have to extend that disappointment with particular politicians to the entire state. You know, mm-hmm. Liberals at gut level, they feel if Trump could become president, that means the system is broken. But we have to verbalize that sort of gut level feeling and take it further. That it's not just that the system is broken because it doesn't put like a likable person in the Oval Office. The system is broken because there should be no Oval Office, and nothing that is focused on democratic governance is going to resolve the problems caused by capitalism.
Right. I just think, the physical argument itself that you're talking about, that essentially, the contradictions in the system, I mean, we're talking about like the system of industrial production, the climate crisis, economics, all parts of it, just the contradictions are so deep and the crisis is so, rapidly unfolding, that whoever comes to power is just, it's not going to be, it's not going to lead to anything that's going to better people's conditions, or at least, make a better life than their parents had. And I think that in itself is a very hard argument to make, especially when a lot of the liberal elites are, campaigning very hard, and, editorials in the New York Times actually calling on the generals in Trump's cabinet to revolt in a coup and, basically, bring the power of the deep state out to unseat Trump. So I'm just curious, maybe if you could spell out for somebody, I mean, I know this would be a whole podcast in itself, but why is it that the contradictions are so deep? Why is it that it doesn't matter whoever could come in to take the reins of power?
Well, okay, you have capital accumulation, right, where more and more of the wealth is concentrated at the top of the pyramid. I mean, that's just the result of a profit-driven system. You know, profit means that more and more of the resources end up in fewer and fewer hands. So that's one source of crises. Another consequence of a profit-driven system is that you have to do things based on whether they're profitable, not on whether they create a world in which a livable world or a desirable world, right? So you have all these economic pressures causing environmental crises. Now, nationalism is a genuinely different strategy for how to respond to that situation than neoliberalism. Neoliberalism is just, we'll pull every barrier out of the way that we can, that would be a barrier to trade, that would be a barrier to profit-driven activity, and hope that like makes life better for everyone, which is like, I mean, it's a rising tide that sinks all boats, really, right? Because like, first of all, you're destroying the biosphere on which all of our lives rest. And second of all, fewer and fewer people are going to be beneficiaries of that. Now, the nationalist alternative to that, the nationalist idea is that, you say, well, capitalism has been stabilized thus far by social democracy. Neoliberalism made social democracy impossible. So how do we maintain the sort of social safety net that was in place under that was in place under social democracy, to at least give the parts of the working class in some of the privileged parts of the world reason not to revolt. You know, how do we solve the problem of social democracy being rendered impossible by neoliberalism? The answer for nationalists is we just narrow the circle of the included. You know, so we mm-hmm. we figure out how to provide, you know, some of the social safety net for like real Americans or for white people or, you know, for some smaller subset of the working class. If you're a white working class person, this is still a stupid bet, right? Because it's just going to be a few more years and the circle of inclusion is going to be made that much more narrow. You know, so if you look, for example, at, you know, anarchists in Greece who've been doing all this migrant solidarity, for any Greek worker, it makes sense to do solidarity with the people who are excluded from the EU, because Greece could be the next, you know, geographic zone to be excluded from that field of privilege. You know, I mean, this is a good time to be establishing solidarity across all the different dividing lines, because, you know, the nationalist model can only buy even the beneficiaries of that model a few more years at the way things are going.
Great. Well, moving on to our next question, and this kind of ties into what we've been talking about, but looking at Trump so far, would you say that he's been a departure from the status quo at all? I mean, a lot of people, you know, spend a lot of time like, is Trump a fascist? Is he a far-right populist? But I mean, looking at what he's done in office, a lot of it has been, you know, slash regulations, roll back things that the Obama administration did to try to curtail the banks and stuff like that. I mean, a lot of like classic neoliberal stuff. Do you see him as a departure from the status quo or just a more extreme version of it? I mean, looking at Trump so far, is he just a really extreme, light white nationalist, you know, authoritarian version of neoliberalism, or how would you place him now?
Well, there's two different forces competing within the Trump administration, as mm-hmm. everyone has been talking about this week, and that's the, you know, the neoliberal business, like oil business on the one side, and then, you know, with Kushner, you know, and then on the other side, the Bannon, you know, the Bannon camp, which is more like explicitly like white nationalism. So it's hard to summarize like a single Trump, you know. I want to say, as I was saying a second ago, I think that nationalism and neoliberalism are different models for how to stabilize or, you know, perpetuate capitalism at this time. And we have actually seen one of the themes of the Trump administration is that we've seen the sort of consensus on the global ruling class break up. You know, we're seeing fractures appear in the global ruling class. So I wouldn't underestimate the extent to which Trump does mark a break, like a new chapter in the history of the state, the modern history of the state, that there's going to be not just Trump himself, but this shows that we're entering an era in which it's not going to be struggles of the people versus the state. It's going to be struggles between many different forces with the state as the battleground. You know, now, as far as Trump himself and his administration, you know, is he a departure from the status quo or just a more extreme version of it? I want to say, you know, a lot of the changes that Trump is looking to enact haven't taken effect yet. You know, wait until the new Supreme Court has been in effect for many years. You know, wait until the FBI and the, you know, the various repressive agencies of the state have the ground under their feet. Right now, they're not sure how hard they can go. You know, and they're not sure actually how divided like the bureaucracy above them is, but we are seeing in Trump like a shift from this sort of model in which a person like Obama or Clinton promises that the state will solve people's problems, you know, and create like a less oppressive like situation. We're seeing a shift from that to, you know, somebody who would say, let's take $50 billion some dollars out of the government and just put it into the military and the police. That is a shift. That's a shift in and how capitalism will be maintained. You know, I had a debate with this. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, in just the, I don't know, just you can see them trying to sell the snake oil. I mean, when they announced, you know, the new budget and somebody asked them, like, how can you take money out of Meals on Wheels and expect us to pay, like, you know, take these billions of dollars and put it towards, I mean, it wasn't just Meals on Wheels. It was everything from that to, you know, programs and resources for people dealing with domestic violence. But, you know, somebody at one of these press conferences asked them, you know, how can you justify this to the average, you know, poor or working person? And they said, well, you know, we think it's about compassion. And, you know, we ask ourselves if we should force the taxpayer to pay for this stuff. And they use the example of PBS, which is, again, this kind of dog whistle to the far right base, you know, because PBS is seen as this, you know, liberal, you know, enclave of, you know, that gets some money from the state. But they said, like, why should we ask people to pay for PBS? But they said, we will ask them to pay for billions in defense. We will ask them to do that. And I think that kind of speaks again to this, you know, sort of proto-fascist kind of thing where it's like, you know, the state will call on the citizen to protect it. You know, at the same time, like, I mean, you know, this, you know, 3 months into the game, you know, they're already this low. I mean, people are already turning on Trump. I think that, you know, the healthcare bill was very interesting because a lot of people didn't like it. Some people thought that it was Obama light and, like, you know, backed the so-called Freedom Caucus. But it just seems like more and more people were hoping that Trump would shake things up and create something different that would somehow benefit them. And, you know, they're not getting that. I mean, obviously one of the most, you know, kind of touted examples of this is the Trump troubadour guy that went around and, you know, stopped paying his mortgage so he could follow Trump around and he sung Trump songs. He's like this big good old boy with a country hat, a country Western hat on, and he sang country songs. But his son died of an Oxycontin overdose, and he really thought that Trump was going to do something about the Oxycontin epidemic in the United States. Uh-huh. And of course, you know, nothing was done. And as soon as he saw the healthcare bill and realized that a lot of poor people were going to, like, be totally screwed and in some cases may die, he totally pulled his support. And of course, CNN kind of brought him on and, you know, paraded him around as kind of this, see, but, it's becoming harder for them to sell what they're doing as kind of Trumpism, as opposed to just politics as usual, it seems like.
I mean, there's going to be a lot of people, like I was saying, who are going to be disappointed. Starting right about now, really, the missile strikes in Syria opened this chapter in which a lot of people who voted for Trump hoping for something are going to recognize that they're just getting more of the same. At the same time as the Trump administration is trying to strike some new deal with the deep state to try to, you know, try to stabilize themselves. So it's up to us really as anarchists to be able to address anybody who isn't just out and out committed to racism for its own sake, you know, to address them and be like, you got played by another billionaire, you know,
right.
Like if you want to like solve your problems, like, you'd better be trying to do it with everybody else who's in your situation or worse, because the people who are in better than your situation are not looking to side with you.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So the next question is, and again, this kind of feeds into what we were already talking about, but as Trump's popularity has declined, we certainly haven't seen a lack of action and mobilization from the insurgent far right. We've seen two big, hate to use the term, but two big days of action on March 4th. And on March 25th, I know in Berkeley, California, there is going to be another kind of alt-right Trump march that's bringing a lot of these people together. But earlier predictions, including from IGD, was that a Trump victory would in fact kind of take the wind out of the sails of the far right and the alt-right. But instead, that to a large degree, it seems that action from anarchists, anti-fascists, and the left has brought various factions of the far right together and is kind of continuing a trajectory and a reason for existence for them. It also doesn't, this trajectory doesn't seem to be stopping any time soon. Now, perhaps the recent bombing in Syria will kind of throw a wrench into those gears. I know that in a lot of these kind of pro-Trump events, definitely seems like the alt-right and kind of neo-Nazi types and white nationalists have definitely been like a not like a driving force in the sense of numbers or even organization, but they've definitely been out, you know, in these events and kind of pushing them forward. Definitely Huntington Beach is an unfortunate example where neo-Nazis right. and people in the alt-right were chanting things like Pinochet as they were beating up anti-fascists and stuff like that. So how do we deal with this thing where we thought basically, oh, you know, Trump will come in, basically all those people will lose their footing, but then all of a sudden there's kind of not a massive groundswell. I mean, we're talking about, you know, rallies of like 100 people to a couple thousand, I think, in the biggest instances. But there definitely is still this kind of like a hardcore base of support for Trump, and it seems to be bringing together weird libertarians, militia types, the alt-right, neo-Nazis, the Klan, all that stuff together in one space. And perhaps the bombing in Syria will, like I said, throw a monkey wrench into that kind of alliance. But I'm just curious, you know, your thoughts on Trump coming in, and we haven't seen a dying down of far-right activity.
Yeah, well, I mean, remember when the election happened and everybody woke up and was like, we live in a country full of fascists, right? I mean, people were terrified, and it was really hard to tell how far that extended, you know, if that was just a protest vote against Clinton, or how many people were actually down with the, like, Bannon agenda, right? And so going into January 20th, you know, you had some clickbait media outlets saying there were going to be 2 million bikers for Trump there. You know, there was this moment when the recent domination of the internet by alt-right people made it possible to imagine that we were in a situation where they had tremendous street power. And that actually has not emerged yet. That hasn't panned out. Now, looking at the events in March, that would have been a great time for Trump to get a bunch of people on the street and show that there were masses of people backing him and his agenda. Because, you know, at coming out of February, he needed to show other Republicans even that there was a mass base for what he was doing. And if he could have shown on March 4th that there was a mass base that was going to punish Republicans who didn't go along with him, you know, ideally that would like carry through his proposals through autonomous grassroots fascist activity on the street, you know, then he would have been in a much stronger position. But from my perspective, the failure of the events of March 4th and the stuff later in March really shows that that they have not actually been able to mobilize like a really broadly powerful far right street movement. That doesn't mean it won't happen yet.
Can you say why you think those events were failures exactly?
Well, because if you compare them to the groundswell of support for Trump himself when he was on his sort of Nuremberg rally tour of the United States, you know, during his election, really, I mean, it's in a historic lineage with the Nuremberg rallies in terms of the environment that's created. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that those rallies topped at a couple thousand people really confirmed that his support ratings weren't just low among liberals, but actually that, you know, the people who knew how to do street level organizing on a mass basis in the Trump era were Trump's opponents. Now, again, I'm not saying that we can rest on this laurel. I think we can congratulate ourselves for doing better organizing than them. But the point here is that they aren't powerful yet, but the events in Syria, for example, that enable the alt-right to differentiate themselves from Trump, as Trump fails, that will actually put them back in the underdog position, which if you buy into what I was saying before, is an advantage for them, you know? They aren't just popular because with the people they're popular with, because they're associated with Trump. They're popular for structural reasons. You know, the same shifts in the economy and in the like the sort of the same like gender anxiety that you have in the United States, the same like white anxiety that produced Trump's victory, are also producing the growth of the far right. And we will have to do battle with them, not just physically, but on the terrain of narrative over and over in over the next several years to make sure that they don't grow to be the most powerful, like, underdog alternative to the ruling parties.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And you bring up the Richard Spencer thing that just happened a couple days ago. There's an article about it on It's Going Down with Social Media Roundup, and lots of very amusing footage of just get in the car, just drive. And Richard Spencer running for miles, trying to get away from, like one person on a bike. But I'm just curious. I mean, in like our analysis, it seems to be that like the alt-right is kind of like having, you brought up the word anxiety, and I think that's that, touches on it. But like, a deep anxiety. I mean, there was just an article that came out that, polls of white males, it says that, there's less than half support for Trump within white males. So, I mean, not only is Trump becoming unpopular, but he's becoming, even more so he's becoming unpopular with, the people that are supposed to most deeply correspond with him. And, I don't know. I'm just curious if you have any thoughts about them basically trying to make an alliance with the left over the war in Syria. I mean, I believe that even Spencer himself brought up we want to make common cause with the left. We want to, unite around this issue of the Syrian war. And I think for them, it's just trying to find another thing to latch onto. They did it with Trump, and now they'll be like, oh, we'll try to do it with the left, over the war, like just another issue that we can use to like have a conversation with people and normalize our position.
Right. Exactly. They're small right now, and so for them, it makes sense to sort of zigzag back and forth between different spaces, trying to pick people up wherever they go, So when Trump was elected, and then they want to be like, oh, Trump's agenda is like our agenda. This is our moment, and then as Trump fails, they're going to be looking around for other allies, right? Other spaces that they can go into and try to accumulate people, because I mean, really, their kind of, their kind of nationalism, their kind of explicit like white supremacist framework is going to be one of the ideologies that's in the running as the sort of neoliberal consensus breaks down. I mean, it's going to be one of the, if you talk about civil war being on the distant horizon, like, civil war can be broken down along a few different lines, but ethnicity and race is one of them. So we have to be very clear about trying to establish the kind of ties across ethnic and social lines so that the conflicts that we have are the ones that are worthy of us. The conflicts, for example, between people and those who want state power or capitalism,
Yeah, I totally agree. And I mean, as you all wrote in an article that came out over a year ago, I can't remember what it was called, but you said, it all comes down to class war, not race war, essentially. And that's what we've got to keep hammering that mantra out. Before we go back to the questions that we have, just to go off on one tangent, one conversation we've been having at IGD is do we talk about the alt-right too much? At what point should we start to be like, they don't have, the infrastructure that we do. They don't have the numbers that we do. They kind of had their moment in the sun with the media, and that's kind of fallen apart. Now, if the media reports on Richard Spencer, it's to talk about the fact that he has a giant cotton farm in the South that he gets millions of dollars from the government for.
Shit, a cotton farm.
Go on. Oh, yeah. You didn't know about this? Yeah,
just. I'm from the South. It's a familiar story, Go on.
But, just to kind of laugh at these people. Should we kind of scale back and basically not continue to raise the flag that, the alt-right is coming, and just kind of talk more about what we're doing and less about what they're doing?
Well, it's a question. There's two different things here. First is a question of priorities. What do we react to? You know, I think that the alt-right felt like something that was about on a scale with us, really, you know, like a like an achievable objective.
Mm-hmm.
And so anarchists are like, well, you know, we want to have a confrontation. Maybe it's a little easier to take on these like clown shoes than to take on the state, you know?
Right.
You know, and to some extent, I think that was desirable because, for example, you know, the Richard Spencer video that went viral after, after J20, you know, basically his like radio play hit, you know, where, if you will, like it was significant that that video was filmed during the inauguration because it identified Spencer and his ambitions with the Trump administration, right? So foregrounding the alt-right as the like poster children for who supported Trump was strategic at that time. But, you know, it's not a good idea for us to lose track of everything else that's happening in society and sort of, just get wrapped up in a private grudge match with somebody else of our scale of organization or smaller. You know, we do really need to be focusing on the ways that the Trump administration and, you know, and other global power structures on that scale are able to make life like unlivable for other people in the society. If we do good organizing around ICE raids, if we, you know, hit the state when they're down, basically, and propose other ways of organizing our lives and demonstrate them so that people can see that as the state collapses or at least fails to be able to deliver on any of its promises, that we are the only ones who have an alternate proposal. Like that really is what we need to be doing, is taking the initiative to demonstrate what our positive program is.
Yeah, and we're going to get into that a little more in the interview. We're definitely going to touch on that. You know, the only other thing I'll say about the alt-right at this point, it's interesting. I mean, I think that looking at them is a really great example of, you know, why you don't attach your horse to a candidate and put all your faith in electoral politics, because I think they are just kind of spinning right now with like, fuck, like we just spent the last year, you know, sharing memes about Trump, and now most of the country, including most of the people that we're trying to make alliances with, fucking hates the guy. And,
that's why structurally this is a good time in history to be an anarchist, which there aren't many of those, you know, but everybody is going to have to come to that conclusion sooner or later, you know, that whoever they're backing in politics, it's just a liability when that person comes to power, you know?
Right. Well, speaking of politics, let's turn towards the left right now. And by that we mean, you know, the official organizations and bureaucratic groups, nonprofits, unions, all that we're talking about, that, you know, have the legal ability to engage with the state and the economy and have been given a certain amount of agency for their role of managing the working class. What are your thoughts on how the big left groups have responded to Trump in the last couple months? I'm thinking of ANSWER, Refuse and Resist, DSA, Democratic Socialists of America. It's kind of picked up where Bernie left off. They say they have about 20,000 members now. How has the left responded to Trump, and just your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, the farther left is using this as an opportunity to do a lot of base building, you know, like Jacobin magazine saying that they're getting, you know, a lot more subscribers or whatever. I imagine that this is benefiting them in the same way that it's benefiting anarchists. The more institutional like left, the left on a larger scale, you know, they came out of the election totally off balance, just not having been prepared for the situation at all. There'd been all this enthusiasm about Sanders. And his failure in the Democratic primaries, I think in many contexts, it took the possibility of a more left democratic solution for our problems off the table for a lot of people, you know. And what Democrats also saw was that all the legitimacy that had been invested in the state under Obama just was passed on immediately. All that power, all that state power was passing right into Trump's hands, you know. So that really shook up left identification with the state and the sort of progress narrative that that a lot of liberal left frameworks are based around. And so the consequence of that, I think, is that a lot of people, you know, sort of nice liberal left people, suddenly had no justification for how to be against us and what we're trying to do. They had to begrudgingly endorse what we were doing. And I think that they sort of, they hemorrhaged supporters to much more radical and anarchistic positions. I just think everything that Obama was doing, that Trump has continued doing, like, I think that's more on the radar of anti-Trump people in a way that is sort of debilitating the Democratic Party. But all right, so what you see here then is all of these like left organizations having to kind, you know, being totally off balance, being taken by surprise, and having to be sort of in favor of anarchist grassroots confrontational organizing. Maybe not explicitly, but kind of like, you know, kind of affirming it or celebrating it. And let me just reach into my like playbook here to see what happens next in this story, because this is something that's happened 100 times before, a million times before, if you look through history, you know, like when the Democrats don't hold any power in the state, when the left is like in a bad position, you know, then what do they need? Well, they need people like us to create a crisis, you know, and what they do is, you know, they're encouraging, they're appreciative, they approve of us. You know, the Washington Post changes their byline to "Democracy Dies in Darkness." You know, it sounds like an album by a straight edge band or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm. Pepsi is giving us tactical advice.
Yeah, thank you, Pepsi. You know, okay, so all of this happens and they're encouraging and they want us to create a crisis, right? They want us to be the foot soldiers, create a crisis, show that Trump can't govern, show that business as usual under Trump is impossible. And then once like some new opportunities open up as a consequence of that crisis, you know, the people in leadership positions, whether it's the like big hotshot activist organizers or the like next like Bernie Sanders, you know, will create will offer the possibility of a new compromise with the state, right? A new social peace in which they sell us out and they get new positions in the halls of power. This is an old story, and this is absolutely what they would never frame it this way, but this is what people up in the hierarchies on the left are already thinking about how to do. So
how to do what exactly?
How to create a situation in which they can turn all the current unrest into new opportunities for them to advance their careers and to get positions in the state.
So what would you say to somebody on the right that's listening to this and would say like, well, it sounds like you're talking about like being the foot soldiers for the globalists or the Democrats or something else. How is this analysis that like, you know, the liberal elites, you know, on quote the left, are looking to use anarchists and other social struggles to create a crisis, but obviously not looking to enact our ideas or somehow support our movement or whatever. But then like counterposing that to this, you know, conspiracy theories about Soros and all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I would emphasize is that no conspiracy is necessary. You know, conspiracy theory is always emerges as a way to distract from what's really happening. So like the Soros mm-hmm. conspiracy theory is just to distract from the fact that everybody who's in favor of Trump is like literally endorsing a billionaire, maybe for free, you know, like,
right.
So similarly, like I'm not advancing some kind of Soros is trying to pull the strings on us conspiracy. I'm saying over and over when I've been in social movements, like, you know, the like hotshot liberal organizer people need us to create a mess so that they can come in and broker peace with the state. You know, I mean, their careers right. depend on us, you know, being unruly enough that the state needs them, you know, but what the state needs them for is to get us under control. So that's why they always have this like militant rhetoric, but also they will always say it is not the right time to do something militant. So, right. you know, the next thing that I anticipate is that once the left organizers, once the Democrats sort of get ground under them, that they will be trying to figure out how to parlay all of this anti-Trump stuff into opportunities for themselves. And what they're going to have to offer in return for those opportunities is they'll have to betray us. You know, I don't mean to look askance at any of the potential allies that we've had in the streets. I think that some of those people may genuinely want to be with us for, you know, for the struggles to come, but we should be very prepared for betrayals on the part of the aspects of the left that don't actually want fundamental transformations of this society.
Yeah, that are also rubbing their hands with the, you know, the very real possibility that, you know, people are going to want Donald back next time around, and they're going to get a chance at power.
Yeah, and in return for that power, they're going to have to show that they can govern, which is to say they're going to have to show that they can get people out of the street, that they can get people to shut up and get with the program.
And Trump is giving them so many wonderful gifts. Well, Obama has too, you know, in that exactly. regard of management, of repression.
Yeah, in that regard, it's just a, you know, from left to right, from Democrat to Republican, it's a steady march towards the security state.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I'm sure we'll touch on this more, but I mean, again, this really speaks to, in my mind, I don't know if you'd put it in these terms, but really critiquing this idea of left unity, and also just, you know, being very clear, like what we're doing and what we're building for. You know, we're not trying to create some sort of popular front where, you know, some mishmash gets in and gets to take power, you know?
Yeah, that's not possible. I mean, left unity, well, is always a framework for people who really don't believe in it. And it's not possible in any case to have unity among those who believe the state is the solution and those who recognize that our freedom and equality won't be vouchsafed by anything until the state has been disabled and abolished.
Right. All right. Well, we talked about the left. You know, let's get down to the nitty gritty. Let's talk about us. Let's talk about us. Since January 20th, and even before, but really looking at what anarchists have done as a movement, can you give us your analysis over the last several months of activity under Trump? What has gone well? Why is this so? What has not gone well? You know, how have we dropped the ball? How have we failed? What can we learn from this? What can we learn from our mistakes? What can we learn from our successes? Just what has this really intense time shown us? Like, what are the big lessons that we kind of really need to take away from these last couple months?
Huh. Well, I want to say we did pretty well considering that the election caught us flat-footed. You know, I don't feel like anarchists were particularly prepared for the situation. We hadn't been thinking about it very hard going into it. A few people had said that Trump was a fascist or something to that effect, but nobody had really grappled on a nationwide scale with the kind of organizing that was going to be necessary, you know, in the situation that we found ourselves in. So in that sense, the amount of organizing, the effort that took place between November and January was admirable. You know, it was counts as a success, you know. I want to say that really the first 2 weeks of the Trump administration, in retrospect, those 2 weeks were the period when all of the determinant stuff happened from the social movement, when all of the events that shaped the context took place. So, you know, I'm talking about the protests on January 20th itself, you know, the airport blockades, which were not just the work of anarchists, but anarchists, you can be sure, played important roles in them. I'm talking about shutting down Milo's talk in Berkeley. Basically, that period of time helped define in the popular imagination what resistance to Trump would look like, and gave people the understanding that if you wanted to oppose Trump, what that looked like was, you know, people in black sweatshirts like taking courageous risks. And really helped shape the public imagination in a way that, you know, that was an accomplishment. Now, what happened starting in February, and wasn't really obvious until a few weeks later that it had taken place, but the social movements, the revolt against Trump sort of reached a plateau, right? And it's exhausting to always be throwing all the banners in a bag and, you know, driving out at all hours of the day. And preparing yourself to go into unpredictable situations, especially once hundreds and hundreds of people have felony charges. But we reached a plateau then, and what happened through February and March really is that we as like a social movement, not just anarchists, sort of got to reap the fruit of the hard work that people had put in setting the terms of what the, you know, resistance looked like under Trump. So as a result, we got to see all of these leaks coming out of Washington, all of these ruptures within the Trump administration and within the bureaucracy of the state, you know, all of these different things that we can claim credit for. I think everybody who makes the decisions about, you know, whether to leak information, or a judge that makes a decision about whether to block the travel ban or something, they're making that decision based on the calculus of the situation that we create on the ground, you know. And the problem, of course, is that once the theater of action shifted to the halls of power, what you have then, instead of people who are like, everything else has failed except me, I have to go out there, you know, with my handwritten sign and maybe turn into a revolutionary, you have everybody, instead they're at home eating popcorn, you know, watching CNN or Slate or The Atlantic, or, you know, just watching these media outlets to see, you know, what their team is doing, you know, in this sort of spectacular, like spectatorship way, right? Now, so in that context, I think, first of all, that's something that we failed to do. We were sort of resting on our laurels rather than challenging the idea that the people who should be the protagonists of the struggle against Trump are, you know, scientists or National Park Service employees or people that we read about in the media, rather than ourselves. You know, we, and I'm talking to you, whoever you are listening to this, you are the protagonist of this struggle. You are not going to get anything out of what takes place in D.C. or what takes place in some like bureaucratic institution that isn't created by your own efforts. You know, we are the ones who have to generate the unrest that creates that. So I think, you know, in the situation that we'd created by February, you know, anarchists continued to show up for anti-fascist actions to counter the street efforts in March. And I think it was really inspiring to see that in many cases, anarchists, and it was explicitly with like confrontational anarchism in the front, you know, were the ones making it impossible for pro-Trump supporters to convey the impression that Trump had a unified base behind him. This is very inspiring to see, for example, this big black bloc in Philadelphia, a city that, like, no offense meant, but has not really been a mecca for black bloc activity, you know, for the last since, let's say, the RNC in 2000.
Yeah, I mean, there was a shit ton of people out there, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that shit ton of people, to use your word, shows that...
To go back down to the IGD level, shit ton of people.
Yeah. It just showed that a lot of people who had not previously been open to using such strategies recognized that that was the effective way to act, you know? But the problem with centralizing anti-fascism is like I was saying earlier, like you and I were saying, it's reactive, and it picks an enemy that is much smaller than the problems that most people are facing. You know, you don't want to create a situation in which the state can be like, we're not fascist, we're just like maintaining the rule of law, but basically, you know, carry out the fascist agenda. So, right. You know, that's some people who witnessed the whole trajectory of Antifa in Europe, in Germany, or the Russian Antifa is a really different story. Cautioned that you don't want Antifa to be your framework because you'll end up with a bunch of socialists and anarchists and communists who have all different agendas all together, liberals, you know, all under the same umbrella in such a way that it won't be possible to make the anarchist argument. Now, I haven't really seen that in the United States. My impression is that Antifa in the U.S. right now is basically like a code word for militant anarchism, which that's fine for me, you know. I think the problem, rather, is that framing what we're doing as anti-fascist just makes us sort of like pumping the brakes on history, but it doesn't suggest that we have a different direction we'd like history to go.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's I think it's also useful for especially the media, you know. I mean, obviously IGD talks a lot of media at times, and I can tell you that over and over again the thing from the media is basically like there's the fascists and there's the anti-fascists. So what that does is allows basically the fascists to basically control the dialogue, and we're just people that that's not nice, or we don't like that, which is not what not what's happening. I mean, there's two movements that have completely different ideas about how the world should be, and
right.
it's in the streets,
Yeah.
On that, I would agree with you. We had the same kind of conversation with, Peter, Gelder-Lowes, and, pretty much, would agree with his position, but obviously there's going to be a shit ton of people that come through anti-fascism right now, and we don't want to poo-poo that. We want to steer it in a direction that is anarchist.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with the media making darlings out of anti-fascists, it makes sense on the one hand, because how do you make anarchism appealing? Well, you show that it's better than the one thing that everybody hates more, or fears more, which is fascism, but we actually have to be doing the hard work right now to articulate the things that we really want, because years from now, we don't want to just be then finally trying to introduce the anarchist proposal, having spent all this time just being the ones who are against the worst possible course of events. We want to actually be doing our hard work right now at this juncture, when we have this opportunity to convey to people what our alternative vision is. Now, this year, they will probably still not be able to believe that it's possible or that it makes sense. But, 3-4 years hence, they will probably be in a situation, many of them, in which they realize that no other proposals are going to work. So this is a time when we have to push the envelope, when we have to try to articulate like another vision. I want to say, before we go on to the next question, I want to say one other thing about media attention also, since you mentioned media. We anarchists have indeed received a lot of media attention in the last few months. And in some senses that's exciting, inspiring, but again, first of all, that media attention, if it just means that the same people I'm describing as being spectators tuning into Washington, D.C. to see how their sports team is doing against Trump, that's not what we want. Also, we don't want people depending on CNN to hear about us. We need people to be hearing about us from us. Mm-hmm. And finally, there is a risk in this. There is a danger, which is that if CNN, if all of these corporate media channels, make us out to be the main enemies of the regime and put us in that position of put us in the crosshairs, basically, where Trump is tweeting about how we're professional anarchists and all this attention accrues to us as the adversaries of the regime. If that happens and we are not able to turn that into on the ground organizing strength immediately, then we will really just have been positioned as target number one so that as soon as things calm down and the security agencies of the state know how much risk they run by targeting us, as soon as an opportunity comes along, they will go after us hard, you know, and the pieces will have been put in place for them to do that by positive attention from the corporate media, you know, because the state will be able to say, well, look, these are the people who pose an imminent threat. They are the ones who admittedly are enemies number one of the administration that governs this country. We have to go after them. So I would caution right. against accruing more media attention than we can immediately turn into grassroots power.
Right. And, you know, we're going to talk about that a little later, but, you know, how do we bring a shit ton of people into our movement? But I'm going to press you on this question once again. You know, the past couple months, successes and failures. What have you seen has been the big successes and the big failures, the big lessons?
Huh? Well, I mean, for me, you always have to aim beyond the target, you know? So, it's not a question of how a particular day went. It's a question of how everybody who hears about that day from a distance is thinking about what it means to resist, right? Our big victories really were that, you know, we responded immediately. I think we helped create an environment nationwide in which people felt that they would not be the craziest ones if they went after Trump, you know? Which people felt that, you know, they could go to an airport looking to blockade it, because blockading was something like that was now thinkable as something that many people were involved in. I think that really, like, it was our organizing that created that environment, or that contributed to that. I don't know. I mean, as far as failures go, like, I would summarize our failures without getting into needless detail. I would summarize them in terms of this question of containment. Like, this is a time when anarchist ideas can spread. They can spread far and wide. When we do our work right, they do. When we make incorrect strategic decisions or stick to rituals that were developed for a different era and a different context, we will find ourselves contained. We can be contained by subculture. We can be physically contained where we're caught in a kettle. You know, we can be contained in such a way where the narrative that is out there separates other people from us, prevents other people from getting with us, you know, from thinking that it makes sense to organize with us rather than with Democrats. But to the extent to which we have been contained, we have failed to rise to this historic occasion and take advantage of the opportunities available to us. If we want to improve on those successes, we have to above all look at the things that have contained us.
Yeah. And I think that's the big question, because I feel like we are kind of stepping into this new terrain of history, and we need to think critically about how we operate as a movement, because we're also existing in this time where the analogy that I would describe it is, I feel like we've entered into a moment where we've kind of run out in front of the rest of or the left, and everybody else is kind of way far behind us. And I think people are kind of looking to see kind of like what we do and how it goes.
And what happens to us. Absolutely.
Exactly. Which is a very scary position to be in, but it's also, you know, one that we've, you know, put ourselves in, and, you know, which takes a lot of bravery and a lot of, you know, ability to insert ourselves in that position. But,
This is like in December, I remember, you know, discussing the situation with people, and I was like, you know, this is actually a really good situation because our worst enemies finally hold power, and and nobody is allied with us, you know, and so we can't be confused with any pro-state forces. It will be clear what side we're on. and it won't be possible for them to retain the legitimacy of themselves being able to pretend that they're rebels, you know. But yeah, what you said really resonates with me about the risks of this moment. If we are repressed and destroyed right now, the rest of society will hear that. They will see that, you know? And so that we really need to do the work to be able to continue to expand faster than the state can crush us. And if we succeed in doing that, like, that will help a lot of people who are currently hopeless to feel like there is something they can do. But if we take careless wrong steps and end up, with our hands tied by having been successfully, not just like struck by repression, but contained specifically, you know, that's the risk we run.
Well, since you brought up repression, let's just talk a little bit about the call for the week of solidarity against repression.
Yeah.
There were several things that were pointed to, and this was a call that was put out jointly by Crime Think, It's Going Down, Submedia. But looking at what's going on with the massive amount of people that are facing charges through grand juries at Standing Rock, I believe it's around 800 or more. There's the over 200 people in Washington, D.C. that are facing charges. There's people that are waiting for kind of the other shoe to drop from the district attorney in Sacramento in relation to the anti-fascist rally that turned violent last year. And just, you know, the general tenor of the country, and both IGD and Crime Think and Submedia have worked together to put out videos and different texts kind of about the push and the normalization of repression in the United States. But yeah, let's just talk about this week of action. How do you think it went? Looking at the list now, there was solidarity events in Thessaloniki, Greece, in Germany. People at Lazad issued a statement and dropped a banner in solidarity with Standing Rock. There was events all across the country that took place. Your thoughts?
Okay. Well, first, I think that a week of solidarity was absolutely the right thing. I never want to rest on our laurels just because we do something and it's a success. I always want to be thinking bigger, you know. I want to take this opportunity to talk a little bit about repression and how we should be responding to it. If we are entering an era when the new state strategy for how to maintain the situation is going to be not some kind of safety net, not some kind of peace treaty with the working class, you know, but is going to be outright brutal, violent repression. That makes how we respond to that repression the determinant thing in how social movements go. You know, we're not talking about being able to like win a wage increase or something like that through like, you know, strikes and like old fashioned protests. We're talking about open clashes with the state, and how we come out of those is going to determine what the horizon of possibility is, right? So looking at repression, one rule of thumb that I think is really important to keep in mind is that from the state point of view, you know, the real goal of repression, the real focus of repression is not the point of impact, but the fractures that result. Not just the place that the blow falls, but the consequences of the blow throughout the community, right? So, you know, yes, they've shifted from charging 20 people with felony rioting to charging 200 some people with felony rioting coming out of January 20th. And that's a change in their strategies, but still they don't think that they can catch and charge every single person who commits a crime or commits something that they consider to be a crime in the course of protest activity and thus control the population. They don't have enough prisons for that even, right? I mean, their goal with repressive strategies is to create fractures in the communities that could engage in resistance against them. That's a way to understand all of these, all the grand juries relating to Standing Rock. It's a way to understand the ways that they are trying to intimidate us, that they want us to be afraid to organize with each other, afraid to trust each other. That's definitely, you know, in past waves of repression, such as the Green Scare, you know, the main thing they wanted to demonstrate was that people couldn't trust each other. It wasn't a question of putting wrongdoers in prison from their perspective nearly as much as it was creating a situation in which those who might engage in resistance them didn't feel like they could share mutual trust. So what we need to do when we are entering these struggles, we need to see repression as phase two of our strategy. We can't be like the 2008, 2009 insurrectionists who were, you know, their strategy basically lasts until they get arrested and then they just have no idea what to do, you know? I mean, seriously.
You're so cruel.
I'm just telling it like it was, you know? I mean, same as I did then, right?
Right, right.
You know? We need to see repression as an opportunity. We need to see repression as an opportunity to create more ties, you know, as an opportunity to extend and expand the fight and the ways that people participate in it. So I really, like, if we were thinking strategically, we wouldn't be understanding ourselves as engaging in actions that then have repression as a consequence. And so unfortunately, we have to take out from the struggle to organize Solidarity Weeks. Rather, we would be understanding the creation of solidarity as one of the most fundamental aspects of the struggle that we're engaged in. We would say, how do we engage in these fights? How do we engage in these confrontations in a way that will create like promising conditions, you know, for solidarity to grow and spread? Because there are a lot of people who won't necessarily be in the streets with us if, you know, just because they're, you know, they're elderly or they have other responsibilities, they don't live in the city. You know, if we can figure out how to tie all of those people together into a much broader social body that identifies with clashes, that identifies with struggles, like, then we'll win, actually. But we have to centralize responding to repression in a way that challenges the state itself as one of the fundamental pillars of our strategy.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, we have to bring that into our framework and our thinking, and that has to be, you know, because it's just inevitable. It's going to happen. And also, I mean, as shitty as it sounds to say, but, you know, using it as a way to, you know, rally people around, because a lot of the people that can do the solidarity work are not necessarily going to be the same people that are going to be on the front lines, you know.
Yeah, make diversity of tactics real, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it also kind of exposes the state hand. It's the state's hand. I mean, like, I think in Sacramento right now, there's a big Sacramento, California, there's a big conversation that could be had. It's like, you know, how can we live in a society where every week a mosque is burned down or some, you know, crazy Trump supporter shoots somebody because of their race, but yet somebody that stands up and say, you know, I'm not going to allow a Nazi rally to happen in my city is going to be facing felony charges.
Yeah.
You know, that's an opportunity to have a conversation with a lot of people. And I don't know, I feel like a lot of times we kind of scale back in those moments and kind of become more withdrawn because
The goal of repression is to make us scale back. And here's the thing. The thing that will protect us from repression is not like security culture. It's not running and hiding, you know. It's that if the movement is strong, if the movement continues, then the calculus that the FBI and the other repressive agencies are using to determine how far they can go is different. You know, they can't go after a vibrant, powerful, widespread movement in the same way that they can after individualized, isolated extremists. You know, so like, if I can take a second to tell a story.
Sure.
The squatting movement in Holland, in Netherlands in the 1970s, 1980s was really powerful. Right. Now, fast forward to the first decade of the 21st century, squatting had just about died down. There were no buildings available anymore. The squatting movement was really weak in the Netherlands. And suddenly, coming out of nowhere, you know, the media started making all of this noise about how violent squatters were doing all these terrible things, you know? And the squatters are like, are you kidding? We haven't done anything violent in 20 years, you know? And really, of course, this was just the government putting the pieces in place to be able to make squatting illegal in ways that it hadn't been before. But this shows that if you want to make a social movement possible, like it, that can survive repression, what you need is a whole bunch of people engaging in flagrantly confrontational activity, because then a much wider number of people will feel that activity is legitimate. They'll have cause to defend others who engage in it. That's much safer than us fragmenting, than us being afraid to speak publicly in favor of the kind of organizing we want to see. You know, we have to put ourselves out there, double or nothing.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think also that gives people an opportunity, that can't, for whatever reason, go out to some Black Bloc demonstration. I mean, here's your chance to like have a rally and like hand out flyers to people. And, kind of have that community dialogue. I know the other day in D.C. on the same night, surprise, surprise, the same night that Richard Spencer tried to do a rally, there was a large event about anti-fascism, about the need to organize against the far right in D.C. that we heard over 100 people came out. And we should be getting a recording with that soon. But, I mean, now's the time to really to do those events, to like have that dialogue with the wider world. And we're going to talk a little bit about that more. And anything else you want to say on that point?
Well, I'll say one more thing about repression, because, some people have asked me recently, how does this period of repression compare to like past waves of repression, like the Republican National Convention in 2008 or the Green Scare in 2005, 2006. I just want to say about that like the real wave of repression hasn't hit yet, like the Green Scare, people were afraid that something like that would happen after September 11th, 2001, but it took like, 4 years before it happened. Right. Similarly, we don't actually know what kind of repression really facing once the security apparatus gets the ground under them, figures out what situation they're facing and what they think they can get away with as far as like going after people, so we need to prepare for that. And we need to step up our social movement activity, in such a way that they'll be afraid to go after us. But knowing that repression is on the way. So when we fight, we need to fight in such a way that we'll be likely to weather the consequences well.
Yeah. And I mean, I've heard this said before, but, something that somebody from many generations ago said about the Spanish anarchists, the 1930s in Spain, when they fought, even if they were going to lose, they wanted to lose in such a way that made the people be on their side.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that you set an example for future generations. Absolutely.
Well, let's look forward a little bit. It seems like things are going so fast and there's so much going on, but May Day still is, less than 3 weeks away now. It's right around the corner. We know that there are calls from a lot of large left groups and a lot of big unions. Supposedly there's going to be lots of big strikes. It also looks like the immigrant movement is really going to be out on the streets on May Day, which is great to see. Some people are saying these are going to be the largest demonstrations since 2006, where there was a wave of wildcat strikes and walkouts of schools. What do you think is at stake for anarchists on May Day, and what do you hope to see, and what is your overall thoughts about where we should be going with May Day? I mean, obviously people are going to look to May Day as an opportunity. It also feels like people have been running themselves so ragged that I'm curious, what's going on in people's minds. But with so much going on, it seems like we have the ability to kind of decide kind of how we want to intervene or engage. I'm just curious if you have any thoughts.
Huh. Well, I mean, first we have to be where the other people are, So if everybody gets in the street, on a day, then we have to be there demonstrating our program, demonstrating our proposals. That's important. But it's also important that we don't overextend, that we don't feel like we always have to replicate the same kind of clash, especially if it's like a really costly clash. We should decide when we fight, when we think it's the most strategic. Mayday is not a situation in which we are responding to an immediate act on the part of the administration or something. Mayday is one of our holidays. It's one of our days of observance, you know, in which we should, you know, foreground our strengths, in which we should do things that bring us together and maybe bring us together with others in such a way that they can see how we're strong and what we might have to offer. And if we're taking actions on Mayday, I would recommend that the strategies that we choose show people who are not yet fighting beside us that we have strategies that can work to solve their problems, you know? So if Mayday was a day when there were blockades of like ICE facilities or something, to show that, you know, that there actually are, you know, that there are people carrying out these deportations and the institutions that do this have names and addresses, you know, to take actions that show, ways that we could be effective in blocking the repressive and oppressive activities of the government. But again, I don't want to see people, get isolated or contained as a consequence of doing things that, you know, the price is too steep, or that they don't open space for more people to get involved. You know, opening space where more people can participate in grassroots anti-authoritarian activity and might be able to ask themselves if they too are anarchists. That's the top priority for us right now.
Yeah, I mean, just to put it another way, I mean, it seems like May Day might be the opportunity to interact with a lot of people and maybe not go so hard that we put ourselves in a situation where we're going to be, you know, defending another group of 200 arrestees. But also just like, you know, what would that look like if people were to do that? Like, what would it mean to have kind of a, you know, a day of talking to people, outreach? I mean, obviously, like, I'm sure actions are going to take place. There's been a call on It's Going Down for lots of disruptive actions, but, and hopefully those happen. But if you're saying, it'll be, perhaps it might be more geared towards, you know, interacting with people, then what do you think that would look like?
Well, we're already in the popular imagination, like I said, you know, I mean, we don't have a problem with being invisible right now. We have a problem with not being widely understood. So, you know, like you say, if some people were able to use Mayday as an opportunity to, to extend and expand, like, the anarchist, like, discourse about this historical moment, like, that would be good, you know, and that can take place many different ways. It doesn't necessarily just look like, you know, standing out there trying to give out flyers and trying to get people to read Kropotkin or whatever. There are ways to take action that show what our critique is, that show what our analysis is. But we don't need to do things gratuitously to try to, like, take the stage of history. We're already on it. You know, the question rather is how to get with enough people that we can stay on it without watering down our agenda one bit.
Yeah, I completely agree. Well, those are all really good points to keep in mind. Moving along to the next question. From our analysis, it seems like a big hurdle for anarchists is how to bring in a lot of people that are interested into our movement. What are your thoughts about the crucial tasks that lie ahead in the coming months and years? And just to, you know, reiterate that, it really does feel that we need to bring a lot of people in. And I think the anarchist movement's ability to do that will kind of make or break it in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think, I mean, just to go back to another story that the same older person told me, they were involved in the miner strike in the 1980s, and they were involved in a group called the Direct Action Movement, which was kind of like a class war anarcho-syndicalist organization, and they did direct support for miners and the miners community in Great Britain that was on strike during the Thatcherite Britain. But the point of the story is that the anarchists behaved and acted so well and did such good organizing, a lot of the miners, or some of the miners, wanted to join different anarchist groups, and the anarchist groups just didn't know how to handle it. They could not kind of like bring in people just off the street that weren't already inundated with, you know, anarchist do's and don'ts, so to speak. Uh-huh. And I think, you know, for so long, the anarchist movement's mantra has kind of been quality, not quantity. And I think we've got to kind of come to terms that, like, yeah, we want quality, but we also need a lot of people involved. And, like, yeah. Having a lot of people involved doesn't mean that we have this kind of massified movement where everybody has groupthink or everybody does the same thing, or that we even have to all be in the same kind of formation or organization or be doing the same thing. But we need a lot of people involved.
Yeah. No, agreed. I mean, the thing I would say that is pressing for us right now is to articulate a positive vision, you know, that having to react to so many developments in the administration and really in the economy and the world around us over the past months has really in many cases just sort of given the impression that anarchists are the most anti of the anti, you know, when in fact we do have, in contrast to most people, we do have a really profound vision of what freedom can be, what it is that makes life meaningful, what kind of relationships people do best in, you know, and what kind of world we want to live in. And it's on us to be able to articulate that, first of all, that sort of guiding star that we're all trying to move towards, and make that comprehensible to others, so that whether they join our subcultural cliques or our consensus-based decision-making, like collectives or federations or whatever, that the anarchist ideal, the anarchist dream of a society in which everyone can fulfill their potential on their own terms, like through, you know, decentralized collaborative networks, like to make that thinkable to as many people as possible. So speaking like more concretely about how to bring people in, I think that we need more infrastructure projects. I'm thinking of what happened in Greece starting in 2012 after the massive clashes of the 2008 to 2011 era, where, you know, Greek anarchists grew tremendously in numbers and really like participated alongside others in massive clashes with the state. 100,000 people on the streets in some cases, like clashing openly with the security forces. But it turned out that clashes were not sufficient to bring about, you know, the deeper penetration of anarchist ideas into the population that was necessary. The clashes really just set up a situation where Syriza could promise people, including some anarchists, that they were going to make things better and people would go for it. So starting around 2012, many anarchists in Greece started to shift towards infrastructural projects. So not just social centers, but social centers that, you know, that provided for the needs of people in the neighborhood, you know? And that, I think, has been a really effective turn in Greece towards being able to demonstrate to a wider and wider range of people that anarchists there have a counterproposal for how our society should look, and that it's possible through anarchist networks to bring that about, you know. Another advantage of infrastructural projects is that they give something for people to do together to develop their ideas. Whatever you might want to say against Food Not Bombs, Food Not Bombs was tremendously important in giving people a space to go through an ideological evolution, you know, between the early 1980s and the beginning of this century. You know, you have people just cooking together, talking, developing their ideas, you know. And in the times of economic crisis and, you know, and also just despair and disillusionment with many of the prevailing value systems, I think this is a really good time for us to be building building the like architecture of another way of life.
Yeah, I more or less agree with you. I guess I think the best way to do that is just in many ways use the infrastructure we already have and expand it. I feel like a lot of times when people kind of go through these, you know, begin to think about this, I think they feel like they have to reinvent the wheel every time. And it's like, I actually think, I mean, you know, we have a lot of stuff. We have a lot of bookstores. We have a lot of, you know, there's a network of IWW union halls that still exists across the U.S. There's, you know, info shops in a lot of different cities. There are, you know, DIY and community spaces. I mean, these things exist, and I feel like a lot of the times people complain about them being underused or understaffed or just not having enough resources. And I feel like if we could go back and kind of, you know, begin to really use those spaces again and bring people in. I mean, I think that really happened in a lot of ways after Trump was selected by the Electoral College. I mean, you saw almost, you know, one of the first things anarchists did, rightfully so, was organize big meetings and, you know, open assemblies and conferences about what should be done and like the things that need to be worked on. Yeah. And I think now we just got to really, we've got to kind of sit back and really get our hands dirty and begin to do those things, begin to put those things into practice. And I think, it doesn't mean necessarily that we have to always reinvent the wheel every time. Like we've got to buy another space or, you know, obviously more is better, but you know, we also have a lot of stuff too.
Well, I emphasize this because, you know, anarchism went through a phase in the United States where people were predominantly focusing on infrastructure around the late 90s. And maybe understandably, anarchists in the first decade of this century sort of reacted against that by focusing elsewhere on trying to precipitate direct clashes with the, you know, the prevailing order, for example. And I think it's tragic that at the precise moment when it would be most beneficial for there to be existing anarchist community projects and infrastructure projects to direct people to, that in some places those have broken down as a consequence of the same economic pressures and social pressures that have destroyed all of the other forms of safety net in our society. So this is a really good time for people to put effort into starting new projects like that in places that don't already have them, and you know, updating the models also. Like if you're listening to this and you know you are freshly curious about anarchism, I want to say to you personally, you have something special to contribute to this moment because your imagination isn't yet shaped by anarchist tradition. You know, you aren't likely to fall into the rituals that that people whose imaginations are shaped by existing anarchism are likely to fall into. Like, you may be able to identify some of the needs that all of the new people who are coming to anarchism right now might have, you know, and to be able to brainstorm infrastructural models that may respond more immediately to people's needs than the kind of info shops and like free food programs that come to my mind on the basis of my decades of experience in anarchist circles when I think about what infrastructure looks like.
Anarchists are now seen as the principal boogeyman of the right and often the regime itself. There is also a growing interest in anarchist ideas. Looking forward, what are the major hurdles and contradictions that you see as a movement that we need to overcome and move beyond? A year from now, looking back, or even several months in the future, you know, after the summer, what would it mean to have moved beyond these contradictions, these things, these roadblocks, and increase our size, our capacity, and our ability to actually go out and do the kind of things that we want to do as a movement? What do you see as the major things that are keeping us from that? And, you know, what do you hope in the next couple months to be able to look back on and be like, yeah, we actually really did kind of grow? Because, you know, I was thinking about it the other day when we kind of wrote a sort of year in review in 2015, and I believe the Crime Think Ex-Workers podcast republished in 2015, or, you know, the read a version of it on the Ex-Worker podcast. I mean, the thing that we, I think that we stressed was that we need to be able to increase our capacity to do things. you know, to grow and to be able to like carry things out. And I really feel like we have done that, you know, since that, especially throughout 2016 and coming into 2017. I feel like we've done that. I mean, it's been baby steps, but we have grown. And we've kind of, you know, worked it out and trying to also too kind of like, how do I say, move beyond the different kind of schisms and the different kind of groups that are out there and the way that they operate. You know, one group does this, the other group does that. It does feel that we are kind of moving and growing, but I'm just curious, again, what you feel is the major things we need to overcome and what would it look like to overcome them?
Well, I mean, thinking about this before, I was thinking much more like immediately, you know, like, just when we're talking about a few more months, you know, the next immediate challenge that's ahead of us is if Trump is trying to broker some kind of new like compromise with the deep state, you know, and that's what we see in his attack on Syria. If he's trying to establish, like you said about his polls, if he's trying to establish some new legitimacy, you know, where he can be like, oh, I'm actually not as terrible as all that. I've demoted Bannon, you know. Then I want to say that that creates a risk for us in the context of what I was saying about the left being likely to betray us and sell us out. I know I'm changing the subject, but I think I want to hit this before we're done with the conversation, because I think this is really important right now. It's up to us right now, first of all, to figure out how to capitalize on and maintain and extend the illegitimacy of the prevailing administration, even as they, you know, even as Trump and his cronies and some of the Democrats, like, try to figure out how to establish some new coalition, some new peace treaty. Like, we have to make sure that we communicate with enough of the general population that, you know, and to convey the narrative that their entire, like, that their entire structure is illegitimate, you know, and to be able to survive through some kind of post-Syria strikes, like, new peace treaty within the halls of power. And to be able to survive after that through betrayals from the rest of the left. And then when power changes hands again in 2 or 4 years, you know, or 8 years, to be sure not to lose momentum when that occurs, not to set up a situation where our narratives and the urgency that our efforts inspire in others can be outflanked by the transition of power to some, you know, some new Bernie Sanders, some new Podemos or Syriza, you know. All of those are like our immediate challenges in political terms. You know, in terms of contradictions within our movement, I don't know. I have never really focused on the anarchist movement itself as the protagonist of history. For me, the anarchist idea is the driving force and should be the center of our concerns. I think that our movement is a consequence of some of us passionately believing in this idea, but the function of the movement should be to inspire others to concern themselves with the idea as well. I think that rather than trying to create a unified anarchist movement as an end in itself, or to make the anarchist movement a player on the world stage in the way that certain socialist factions are, I think that what we really need to do is create an environment in which everybody, wherever they're situated in society, finds themselves drawn more and more towards anarchist ideas and perspectives. And that will mean the emergence of many different anarchist movements. That will mean the emergence of many different ways of pursuing the anarchist ideal. I don't think that we need to seek anarchist unity either. You know, we need rather to create an ecosystem or a biosphere in which it's possible for people to engage in many different anarchist experiments, but in which the baseline, like, unifying value system is that no one should hold power over anyone else. You know, that it's undignified for people to rule or be ruled. And so that's the real question for me. You know, how do we use the institutions that we have? How do we use the momentum that we have as a movement to catapult our ideas far beyond the context in which we're organizing, so that we will see them emerging in other contexts, because we may not be situated to be the ones who are able to most intelligently employ them to meet everyone's needs. You know, we may need to see anarchist movements arise in totally different contexts in which people can show us what's useful about the anarchist critique to them.
Yeah, I would more or less agree. I'm not trying to argue that we need to have one united thing.
I didn't mean to accuse you of that. No.
No, I'm just...
I mean, really like the way that many different anarchist groups have come together in the urgency of the situation since November. I only wish to emphasize that, like, even when we act together, we are so small compared to the kind of social force that we need to create, that we need to understand ourselves not as the protagonists of this moment in history, but as people who are able to speak to the, like, much larger numbers of people who need to be those protagonists.
Yeah, and I think that's how anything will ever be. I mean, if you look at anything in history, that's how usually it's gone down, you know, right? That you have, you know, a smaller movement that has, you know, very specific goals, and that links up with large amounts of people that are self-organizing, taking action, you know, just angry and fed up. I mean, what differentiates us from, you know, communists and socialists is they want to use that moment to create a state out of it, where we
exactly
want to create, you know, an actual human community that is autonomous, decentralized, and, you know, sustainable.
Right.
The only thing else I want to pick your brain on, I know we've talked about it throughout the program, but I want to get Crime Thinks analysis on the Syrian bombings. I mean, what do you think of it? What do you think this means? How should anarchists respond?
Well, all right. We published a text, Take the Offensive, now well over a month ago. We published at a time when it seemed like the crisis of legitimacy that the Trump administration was facing could actually turn into a situation in which the state would rupture, you know, and there would be a power grab. And, you know, in which the deep state might actually try to replace Trump. And we, you know, we sort of did the thought experiment, right? We were like, if Trump is a real crisis of legitimacy, which of the outcomes, you know, is most desirable, and how should we conduct ourselves in that kind of situation? You know, we imagined maybe there would be a crisis of legitimacy that actually, like, came to a head. But really what we thought was most likely was that the deep state would rein Trump in some way. You know, and when I say the deep state, I know I'm using a term that has recently become popular with the alt-right, but goddammit, we were using that term long before them. I mean, by the deep state, I mean, you know, entrenched elements in the CIA. I mean, you know,
right,
like, you know, I mean, the corporations that fund the government and all of their interests, right?
We need to start calling the alt-right the deep trolls.
Thank goodness. I mean, the thing is, they're not even deep, you know, they're like a...
Like, the surface level,
yeah,
scum.
Yeah,
anyway,
exactly.
Go on with what
the
you're
deep
saying.
State and the superficial scum. There's your little header.
Yeah,
you know.
There you go.
But you know, we speculated that at some point the deep state elements of the government would manage to rein Trump in. You know, they'd be like, okay, you can carry out the, like, ordinary racist domestic aspects of your program, but it's not okay for you to change foreign policy initiatives. You know, it's not okay for you to mess up the economy with sort of nationalist protectionism. Yeah. And that really, I think, is what we're seeing here. I think it's hit home for the Trump administration that they have basically failed on almost every front since they were elected. And the, like, Kushner current within the administration is now trying to make some kind of new peace. You know, that it's typical, I guess, of the United States that internal conflicts in the halls of power would be resolved by symbolic military strikes in other parts of the world. Now, I mean, there's other aspects to this, which is that the Syrian quagmire continues to draw in new participation and to create new tensions on the global scale. But what I think Trump is trying to do here, you know, is separate himself a little bit from Steve Bannon and the white nationalists and try to broker some kind of new deal with the rest of the government. I think that if he's able to do that, that could be bad news for us. You know, if he's able to create a more stable situation on the national level, because then, you know, if anarchists are just regarded as criminals who fight other criminals and they alt-right, then Trump, you know, standing at the helm of a stabilized state would be able to play like the stern father, like getting everybody in line again. And I think a lot more people would be willing to put up with a lot more repression of like so-called extreme, like social movement participants, like, you know, like anarchists or whatever. I think that's a real risk. But it's not entirely clear how much this signals a shift in the direction of the Trump administration, really, just because Trump's management style, as many have written, is itself sort of mercurial and unpredictable. For me, the ideal situation is that he's just thrashing around the way that he always does, and that he won't be able to cash this in as like a new legitimacy or a new ability to cooperate and co-organize with Democrats. I guess we will find out.
Yeah, actually, and you're only going to hear this here. It's going down. Sent Noam Chomsky three questions to see if he would grace us with his presence. For years, he's been calling himself an anarchist, and we felt it'd be time for him to engage with an anarchist website. But we asked him what he thought about the Trump administration's moves against Syria and if they were serious about regime change. He was very brief and gave us one-sentence answers for each of our questions. But he said he doesn't see any reason to suppose that Trump is committed to regime change and sees it as kind of a calibrated one-off affair, that this is kind of something that will distract people from any allegations about Russia and tries to rally people around the flag and all that stuff. He also went on to say that there, you know, like we've been talking about throughout this interview, but there's been many internal contradictions in Trump's program, and they're reflected in the chaos around all the different advisors and all their different things they're trying to get into Trump. And
he's reading the same things I am, right? Go on, though. Sorry.
Thanks, Grandpa Gnome.
Yeah.
Yeah, we actually wrote back and said, well, if you can expand this into like a paragraph for each answer, we can actually publish it. But yeah, is there anything else you want to say about Trump? I mean, we've been talking about it for a long time. Syria, just any of the things we covered. This has been a great interview, covered a lot of ground. This will be great for people kind of like mulling over, thinking about the time ahead. It just feels like, I mean, that this is a time to kind of like think about what's been going on in the past couple months and really think critically and just think about where we kind of want to go. And how we want to proceed.
Yeah, this is what I want to say, I guess. We have just lived through a tremendous window of possibility, based on previous experience in such windows. They never last as long as you think they will. Usually by the time you realize you're in the midst of such a window, it's already closed, you know, and usually anarchists thrash around in the, like, you know, in the aftermath of these windows of opportunity, trying to figure out, you know, what to do until they realize that the battlefield has already changed and the fronts have already moved on. But at the same time, history is moving faster and faster nowadays. I think that there will probably be another window of opportunity with different stakes and different players soon, you know, possibly as a consequence of the actions of the Trump administration, maybe on another front, you know.
Can I ask you exactly why you think that window of possibility is closed?
Well, when I say that, what I mean by a window of possibility is that at the onset of the Trump administration, we got to determine what resistance to Trump could look like. You know, we were really the ones who called for the militant demonstrations, who set the terms, and we did so. We did so successfully. And that really, like, hats off to the people who poured into the streets the night following the election. You know, that set the tone, and it only remained to anarchist organizers and others to follow that up with a second phase, you know. But now we are in the Trump era, when people who could not believe that they were entering a situation in which Donald Trump would be their president have basically made their peace with this in some way. I think that it would be a mistake, until something new happens, to think that anti-Trump people feel the same urgency to make a break with, you know, with this reality now that they did in late January. And we see that really in the, like, half-hearted attempts to praise Trump's Syria strikes, you know, that you see from some Democrats. You know, this is people trying to figure out how to come to terms with the situation. This is why I'm saying that, you know, right now, rather than acting like if we just go harder and harder, there'll be more and more people with us, I think that we need to figure out how to consolidate the gains that we have made and try to prepare for the next round of opportunities, which could come as soon as this summer.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, the metaphor I like to use is kind of like a boa constrictor, you know, like where sometimes we attack and we tighten, and then we kind of rest a bit and we stay, and then we go in again, you know? But we've got to consolidate, like you said, and stay strong. And, you know, these contradictions aren't going to go anywhere. I mean, things are only getting worse, and they will only continue to get worse if a Democrat comes into office. So, yeah. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for the Crime Think Ex Workers Collective for doing all they do. You know, being, you know, kind of a guiding light throughout the years. Anything else you want to say? Anything about Crime Think? Any projects or, big pieces that are, you know, looming on the horizon?
Well, we have a lot of projects on the way, including these two new books about democracy and about solidarity work on the U.S.-Mexico border. We'll have a lot of things to share with people shortly that we're really excited about. But the bottom line for us is, like, it's bad luck to talk about things in advance. It's better just to do them, right? So you can expect another 20-some years of activity out of us if all goes well. The other thing I want to say in closing, thanks to you for organizing this, this discussion and this platform for people to be in strategic dialogue. I think IGD has been one of the examples of successful infrastructure building that's taken place over the last couple of years, and sets an example for how ambitious every anarchist should be thinking, how ambitiously every anarchist should be thinking about what our projects should be and what scale we can operate on. Finally, I want to say to the listeners, if you are one of the people who has taken the kind of courageous action that has made the changes in the world that we've been discussing in the course of this episode possible, like, I am grateful to you. I recognize that it was not easy. I'm grateful for the risks you took, and to everybody else who is considering stepping forward in that way, thank you also for the chances that, you know, that you are going to take for all of us.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Have a good evening there.
Boom, and we are done. Thank you for Crime Think for talking for so very long with us. It was well worth the wait, well worth sticking around. We hope you enjoyed that conversation. We hope you got as much out of that as we did. And hey, if you want to stand up, if you want to support It's Going Down, if you want to make sure that we are in it for the long haul, which we are, please log on to our website, itsgoingdown.org. Hey, put some money in our tip jar, please. And we want to say once again that very soon we will be switching over to Patreon. So maybe think about, hey, if you got $5, $10, $20, maybe even some more that you can spend every month to help support us, hey, think about doing that, please, because we intend to be here for the long haul and we intend to have you with us. And again, if you want to come on the show, all you have to do is email us at info@itsgoingdown.org. Hey, if you've got a project, something going on where you live, big or small, it does not matter. We would love to have you come on the show. Let's do something. Let's make it happen. And as always, you can stay up with us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and of course on itsgoingdown.org. Thanks a lot. We have a lot more planned, a lot more in store. Stick around. We will be here. We know you will be too. We'll see you then.